Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, American specialist in veterinary oncology, Owen Davis. Thank you, Owen. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, thank you, Sammy, and thank you all to everyone who's come to this webinar. Today we're going to talk about mast cell tumours, and we're going to do so with the help of Muppet. There he is. Muppet's a really interesting clinical case, but I've chosen Muppet because if we understand all the information around all the decisions that were made, then I think we're going to understand all that we need to in dealing with canine mast cell tumours. So let's get going. Muppet is a 9-year-old male neutered golden retriever who had a mast cell tumour around 2 centimetres in diameter ish, removed from over the right hock. Okay. At the time of the surgery, the popliteal lymph node palpated normal size. And Muppet's referring vet was a very diligent guy, he did a great job, and realised that normal size of a lymph node doesn't necessarily mean that it's not metastatic. So he took an FNA, and we found no evidence of metastasis on the FNA. So that's all good. The pathologist told us the tumour was of intermediate patentic grade, low cupal grade, and had low mitotic activity. It was also completely excised. So these things, at the very least, then, are not scary. The pathologist pointed out that the histological features on their own may not give a firm prognosis, so the pathologist offered lots of other tests. And we had very committed owners who wanted to do them, and they pointed towards a favourable prognosis. So that's all good too. So all looks good for Muppets, but then this happened. 13 days post-surgery, day before the stitches were going to come out, Muppet's leg swelled up to twice the size of the other one. And Muppet was being sick and had diarrhea and had purpura in the groin. Muppet was referred to me with some urgency, and we found the inguinal lymph node was absolutely massive. And on cytology, surprise, surprise, was full of metastatic mast cells. So, how then did a mast cell tumour, which apparently had no negative prognostic features, metastasize? And how then did a mast cell tumour with a clean local lymph node metastasized further down to the inguinal lymph node? How can we spot the ones that have metastasized if the local lymph node's clean? And now we've got a dog with a swollen back leg and a metastatic mast cell tumour. How do we treat him? And these questions, ladies and gentlemen, will be our learning objectives. Okay? By the end of this session, everyone here will be able to confidently answer all three of these questions. We'll start with question one. How can you tell if a mast cell tumour is going to spread? Mast cell tumours are probably the most annoying problem, or one of them, that we face. The problem is that each and every one of them is a cancer. But that can mean different things for different tumours. Mast cell tumours represent the whole spectrum of malignancy here, from tumours that behave as if they're benign and never cause a problem, to tumours that spread like wildfire and rapidly bring about the death of the dog. However, these extremes are rare. Most mast cell tumours come back somewhere here. Wouldn't you agree? With most mast cell tumours, we're trying to communicate a shades of grey situation to the owner, and the fact that we haven't instantly got a yes, it's good, no, it's bad type of answer for them. But in one of the first things we deal with the owners, we can say that around 80% of mast cell tumours will be cured with adequate surgery alone. And that can provide a little bit of reassurance that's often very much needed. To choose which mast cell tumours are at risk of spreading, we have to assess a long list of prognostic factors. And if you've been following the literature, you'll know that there lots and lots of things have been reported to be prognostic in mast cell tumours. But I'm going to present the ones that I regard as important. And these start with signalements and presentation. If you look at a mast cell tumour across the room and you physically gasp, then it's probably bad. Okay? So the ones then that are really big and red and ugly and ulcerated, they look bad and they often are bad. But the opposite isn't necessarily true. If you've got a mast cell tumour that looks fairly unassuming, then it may be fairly indolent, but it could also be bad. It doesn't quite work that way. But if you have a mast cell tumour that has definitely been in situ for over 6 months and still remains at a very small size, then that is probably one of the ones that will be cured with local excision only and one of the ones we don't need to worry about. So the key word's probably there. Brachycephalic dogs tend to have a higher proportion of less aggressive mast cell tumours. Sharpeys will have a higher proportion of more aggressive mast cell tumours. But don't let this fool you because some of the most aggressive mast cell tumours I've ever seen have actually been on the brachycephalic dogs. Anatomic site's very important too. Subcutaneous tumours or tumours distally on limbs have been suggested to be less aggressive than those of other sites. Mast cell tumours of the mucous membranes, the prepuce, the scrotum, the perineal area, and of the nose have been reported to be more aggressive than the others. As a kind of no-brainer, those with local lymph node metastasis at diagnosis will be more aggressive tumours, and those with systemic disease, as in swelling, purpura or gastrointestinal signs are those with a higher burden of mast cell disease. Not necessarily, or rather not directly, through any features of the mast cell tumour itself, but just meaning that there's more cancerous mast cells degranulating there. And the other thing we can take from this is that if a dog has a little mast cell tumour of several centimetres in diameter, then that's not going to be responsible for the gastrointestinal signs or the large purpura here. To get signs like this affecting the whole body, you need a high burden of malignant mast cell disease. Stage, which kind of goes with the metastatic status, really, then what those who have distant mets or regional mets will do worse than those who don't, and also those that recur will be more aggressive tumours than those that don't recur. And this is kind of independent of whether they've been incompletely excised or completely excised. If you incompletely excise a mast cell tumour, it's only about 30% of them that will recur anyway. So a recurrent mast cell tumour is always a concerning feature. And note, we've done all this before we've started talking about the histopathological features. The histopath features are very strong, particularly the grade, mitotic activity, and some of the proliferation markers. We can also do things like the c-Kit mutation or immunohistochemistry for where the KIT protein is found in the cell. And these are all very useful features too. So after you've considered as thorough a list of prognostic factors as possible, I will recommend putting a mast cell tumour into one of two categories, either high risk of mets or low risk. And at this point, we don't accept something that's in between, possibly this, possibly the other. We have to do this as thoroughly as possible. The high risk mast cell tumours are those with significant negative prognostic factors. And it can be difficult because sometimes, quite often, you get contradictory prognostic factors. For example, you might get a subcutaneous mast cell tumour with a high mitotic activity. You may get a mast cell tumour that looks histologically unscary, but on a Sharpei dog. And this is where we get the shades of grey coming back again. There's no clear way of rectifying this other than making a judgment call. I would consider the strength of each factor and whether it's been reported as a strong independent factor on several publications or just a suggested prognostic factor in one publication. But as a quick summary, I think the histopathologic features, for example, the grade, mitotic activity, and Ki-67 will be some of the strongest prognostic factors we see. And these things will override how long the owner thinks the tumour has been there. Okay? Metastatic status, again, a no-brainer, would be a very, very strong negative prognostic factor, as would the mucous membrane location. So you consider what the strength of each negative prognostic factor you have is, and then you have to make a judgment call. And I'm not going to lie, particularly when you're starting out, that can be a difficult one. So people like myself are very happy to give advice wherever needed. Here's some examples of the high-risk mast cell tumours. Those that grow like the speed of lightning and make you gasp as you look at them across the room. Those of mucous membranes or the prepuce, those with lymph node mets, systemic signs, and remember that tells you you've got a large burden of disease, and to get a large burden of disease, it tends to be the more aggressive tumours. Those that recur locally, perhaps those of the sharp A, and the things on histopathology. So a lot of these prognostic factors are fairly intuitive, apart from the histopathological ones, and we'll go through those in a bit of detail now. Here's my spectrum again of malignancy. The really aggressive malignancies here, the less aggressive ones here that are effectively benign. And we know that mast cell tumours can be anything all the way through the middle. Now the grading systems seek to chop up this spectrum into categories. This is the PACnic grading system from the 1980s, and it's the most tried and tested. Now the PACnic grade 1 tumours we know should be expected to be effectively benign. PACnic grade 3 tumours will be very aggressive, and we give these a poor prognosis. But what do we do for the intermediate grade? What do you do for those? Because actually these intermediate grade tumours can be like the grade ones, or they can be like the grade threes. We just don't know. The other thing you'll see here is that in the first publication on the system from the 1980s, about 60% of tumours were PACnic intermediate grade. Now it's actually about 80%. 80% give us this unclear nebulous category. So in recognition of that, the cupule grading was set up, and the premise is very simple. You've got those that you don't worry about and those that you do worry about. Nice and easy. Okay? And the cupule system will cut the PACnic intermediate grade about here, where 86% of the cupule lows are PACnic intermediate and 14% of the cupule highs are PACnic intermediate. Now, the grading systems work in very different ways. Let's look at the features of the PACnic one. The degree of cellular differentiation, degree of invading the basement membrane, level of stromal reaction, level of cellularity. Okay. So despite the PACnic system being well evaluated, it relies on quite subjective assessment here. And consequently, it has an alarmingly low agreement between pathologists, 50 to 62% agreement, ladies and gentlemen. If you send it to two different pathologists, the chances are very high you'll get two different answers. Now, the cupule system counts things. So these are objective, aren't they? Mitotic figures, number of multinucleated cells, number of bizarre nuclei. And so the cupule system has a much higher level of agreement between pathologists. Okay? But one of the disadvantages of the cupule system is it's only been around for a few years and it's less tried and tested. It's worth also pointing out that both these grading systems have been evaluated in the most common category of mast cell tumours, which is the cutaneous ones. And for the subcutaneous ones, or the mucous membrane ones, they haven't been very well validated. Okay, so we should really only talk about these for the dermal mast cells. Now let's look at some survival curves here. If you haven't seen these, they're actually really easy. On the y-axis, we've got 100% of dogs alive and 0% of dogs alive down here against time. So it follows that the groups with the best survivals will have a curve that is near 100% for longer, and it'll be up here. And those that have the poorer survivals will have a curve that gets down to zero sooner down here. And the fact that we've got three distinct curves for the Patnik system and two distinct curves for the Kuppel system shows that the grades have a very, very significant bearing on the prognosis. On the Patnik system, if we get a high-grade tumour, we know what we're dealing with. Average survival 40 weeks, 60 to 95% are metastatic. Okay. On the Kuppel system, again, a high-grade tumour, we know what we're dealing with. The average survival 16 weeks, 30% are metastatic at diagnosis. What about the other grades? You see, 10%, or average 6% of the Patnik grade 1s will metastasize. 17% of the grade 2s. 15% of the Kuppel grade 1s have metastasized at diagnosis. And the bottom line is here that 15 to 30% of the grade 1, grade 2 mast cell tumours will result in death of the patient. So grade then, it is important, it has a lot of prognostic value, but it's certainly not everything. So after you've looked at the grade of the mast cell tumour, please look at a proliferation index. Now, uncontrolled cellular division is one of the hallmarks of cancer set out in these very eloquent articles that are publicly available, should you wish to read them. Okay? And it follows that a tumour with a faster rate of uncontrolled cell division will be more aggressive than a tumour with a lower rate of uncontrolled cell division. And the first proliferation index to look at is the mitotic count. Here's our survival curve again in the top right here. This is tumours with a mitotic count of 6 or above have a survival that's down here versus a very, very different survival curve for those of 5 or below up here. What's great about mitotic count is that it is completely independent of the tumour grade. And you see it here for the grade 2 tumours, two distinct curves, and two distinct curves for the grade 3 tumours too. Okay. The limitations of the mitotic count, however, is that sometimes a pathologist could legitimately confuse a nuclear abnormality with a mitosis. Mitoses vary per region of the tumour. If the section is of a hypoxic region of the tumour, then the rate of cell division will have slowed down. The size of a high power field can vary from microscope to microscope. Okay, so mitotic count can suggest a tumour that will behave in an aggressive way, but it, like grade, is not everything. So, taking one step further, we could look for other proliferation indices. I don't know why, but these things always have complex names. The two ones principally used for mast cell tumours would be Ki-67 and Agnor, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Ki-67 is by far the best evidenced and is also another independent prognostic factor, very, very useful in mast cell tumours. You can see the first benefit of this here, in that this is the cell cycle, okay? If you're just counting the mitoses, you're just looking at this tiny yellow area here. The Ki-67 index will tell you the cells that are in this and this and this section of the cell cycle too. So it's a much more robust assessment of the cells that are in the cell cycle. Here are the survival curves, and again, two very distinct curves for all grades, and just the independent and the grade 2 tumours here. So the bottom line, Ki-67 is very useful. Now, Agnor's another proliferation index, and you might be forgiven to think, well, if I've got mitotic index and I've got Ki-67 index, why do I need a third measure of cell division? And the answer is Agnor gives you slightly different information. Mitotic index and Ki-67 will tell you the proportion of cells that are in the cell cycle. What if the cells are cycling at a very slow rate, however? That's where Agnor comes in. Agnor tells you the speed at which cells are going through the cell cycle. Okay, so from a first principles point of view, it gives you complementary information to the Ki-67 index. There are a couple of limitations of this test, though. The first thing is that assigning a cutoff is just mathematically difficult in a lot of studies, and they're not able to give you a reliable threshold above which we worry about the tumour, below which we don't. And for this reason, it's often combined with the Agnor, with the Ki-67 as well. Again, Ki-67 talks about proportion, Agnor talks about speed, so in theory, they should be complementary. However, there aren't many publications that have very holistically assessed Ki-67 versus Agnor and its independence versus other prognostic factors. So I guess it's not very well evaluated at the moment. So in summary, the mitotic count tells you those cells that are in mitosis. Ki-67 tells you those that are in the cell cycle, a much more robust assessment. Agnor tells you the speed, and PCNA is in quite a lot of publications you may read, but it's not very, offered very commonly in the UK at the moment. It's similar, but not quite as good to Ki-67. Proliferation indices can also get things wrong. Again, you still could confuse them with nuclear abnormalities. Still varies between areas of the tumour, can vary between microscopes, vary even between users. And as these are immunohistochemical tests, if you overcook the immunohistochemical reaction, you can get false. So particularly, Ki-67 is very, very useful, but it's not infallible. It's not everything. When do I request these tests? Well, I think it's very important to think of them where you have a borderline mitotic index in a cupel low grade or PACnik intermediate grade tumour. That is a mitotic index 4 to 6, something like that. Okay. Also, when you've got no negative prognostic factors so far, and you just want to assess the tumour from a completely different angle, these are independently prognostic, so they're not going to be co-occurring with certain grades, for example. I think it's legitimate to do that, just to make sure you're being thorough. And the other thing you might want to consider them for is to resolve disputes you have. That is, for example, a rapidly growing ulcerated tumour, yet the pathology report suggests it's low grade. Or a grade 2 tumour with a low mitotic index could have spread to a local lymph node. I might request Ki-67 on this, thinking the mitotic index could have got it wrong. Now, another test that pathologists often offer is c-Kit gene mutation status. The KIT protein is found on all mast cells and many other types of cell. And we found that around a third of canine mast cell tumours have become malignant by virtue of a mutation in this protein. This protein should normally incur cell division in response to a ligand binding to it. But you can get a mutation in a third of mast cell tumours that means that the protein's always firing, always trying to get the cell dividing, despite a ligand not being bound to it. Okay, these tend to be the most aggressive third of mast cell tumours too. So you can do a PCR test for this mutation. It can be done on slides. It can be done on formalin-fixed tissue as well. And knowing the answer, would help predict the behavior, at least. C-Kit mutation positive tumors more likely to be aggressive, and it can also predict the drugs that could, potentially be used to treat it. A mutation positive tumor is more likely to respond to tyrosine kinase inhibitor therapy. We'll talk more about that in a minute. However, on the note of the prognostic effect, the independence of this is uncertain. That is, the c-Kit mutation positive tumors could be the ones that actually happen to be high grade or high Ki-67, and it could just be co-occurring with that rather than driving the prognostic significance. But you get mutation negative tumors that respond really, really well to tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and mutation positive tumors that don't respond so well. It's also a test that typically costs a few £100 and you have to wait a few weeks. So, from a variety of reasons, I find I'm running this a lot less than I am Ki-67. And the final prognostic factor we'll discuss here is the KIT protein staining. So, we're not checking for the genes or mutations here, we're checking for the protein signified by the capital letters. Now, there's three patterns that have been described where you get the KIT protein where it should be on the cell membrane. That's up here. Pattern two is where you get the protein in a stippled form in the cytoplasm, or pattern three where it's diffusely in the cytoplasm here. And these are aberrant locations that you find in the mast cell tumours. However, some mast cell tumours have it just on the cell surface, and those ones have a good prognosis. The significance of pattern two, where it's in the cytoplasm, is much less clear. So it can be a useful prognostic finding and a strong prognostic finding. However, this test could be criticized because it's often finding the ones that are very, very well differentiated at the nicest end of the low-grade tumor spectrum. So again, the independence of this prognostic effect is uncertain. It could just be finding those that we already know are low worry. So I'll summarize the histological prognostic factors I've discussed: grades, mitotic index, Ki-67, independent, reliable, shown to be valuable in many studies. The other tests here are less well evaluated. And studies have shown prognostic significance. Some studies have, some studies haven't. But most importantly, the independence of their effect is not certain. So let's return to MUPPET and some prognostic factors we've learnt about. Well, MUPPET's tumour wasn't mucosal. And MUPPET isn't a Sharp A. And at diagnosis, the tumour wasn't known to be metastatic. And it wasn't a PAPNIC or cupal high grade. And it didn't have a high proliferation index. So what's going on here? Now, this was one of the toughest mast cell tumor cases I've ever dealt with, so I'm not going to pretend that this is mainstream. But in these difficult cases, go back to the histo report and read the bits that you've probably shied away from reading, the boring bits. This is where the pathologist's expertise comes over. This is where they earn their money. Let's refresh our memory of the PAPNIC grading system, talking about cell differentiation, mitotic activity, invasiveness. Now, as the PAPNIC grades increase, these things roughly, approximately, will increase in proportion to each other, mostly. If we look at MUPPET's report, we know it's of low mitotic index. They say mild to moderate anisocytosis and anisocaryosis. But look at this, invasion marked. Streams of neoplastic cells deeply penetrate stromal tissues, dissect through subcutaneous fat. Large areas of edema and necrosis. You don't often get necrosis on the histopath of a mast cell tumour. So this invasion marked is highly disproportionate to the well differentiation of the cells, the good differentiation of the cells, and the low mitotic activity. OK, Okay, this is a significant anomaly we're getting on the histo, an anomaly with a PATNIC grading system. So we found actually that, with hindsight being a beautiful thing, we could have predicted that this may not have followed the rules. Where you get an anomaly on the histo, the pathologists are often really good at flagging it to you. And where they're pointing out that things like, I'm giving this an intermediate grade because of this, that, or the other, but I feel this particular feature is disproportionate to the others, then it's worth listening to them because they're usually right. They're usually pointing out a tumour that is not going to follow the rules, and perhaps for this particular tumour, the grading system is not appropriate. And that, I think, is what's happened with Muppet here. It's a very difficult case, and if you get cases like this, people like me are more than happy to discuss them. But that brings us to the end of question one. And on prognostic factors, does anyone have any questions? So I've got a question here. Is hypercalcemia due to mast cell tumour possibly? Likely. Actually, we don't often see mast cell tumours making dogs hypercalcemic. I would presume then, if I saw a hypercalcemic mast cell tumour case, that it would be correlating with a very wild mast cell tumour that's out of control. So I might say, if that happened, yes. But I would also think, because the prevalence of hypercalcemia and mast cell tumours is very rare, I've not confidently ever seen a dog with a mast cell tumour that's been hypercalcemic because of the mast cell tumour. I would also think perhaps there's something else causing the hypercalcemia here. Common things might be lymphoma, Addison's, primary hyperparathyroidism, renal disease, etc. Fine. We'll go on to question two now, and if you've got any more questions, we can look at them at the end. How do we look for metastasis? This is all about staging, isn't it? Looking for mets. Mast cell tumours metastasise via the lymphatics pretty much without exception. So if you're looking to see if the mast cell tumour spread, you follow the lymphatics and you start at the primary tumour and you end up at the liver and spleen, which are effectively the biggest lymph nodes in the body. So you just trace that line between tumour and liver and spleen. And looks can be deceiving. You can get normal size lymph nodes that are effaced by metastatic disease, and you very, very commonly get normal looking liver and normal looking spleen that contain metastatic disease. You're not going to see nodules here, you're going to see diffuse infiltration. So looks will be very, very deceiving. And you need to aspirate things to find out whether they've got mets in or not. So this is a normal lymph node here at low power, and you can see the background small lymphoid cells, and you can see all these extra really large cells in there. If you look on high power, you can see they're very, very pleomorphic, huge variation in size, shape, nuclear form, and you can hardly tell that they're mast cell tumours here, only in a few of them. You can see a few granules. So this is a very poorly differentiated mast cell tumour that's metastasized. A more typical picture of mast cells would be this, where you've got the characteristic purple granule, and that might be more the case for an intermediately differentiated mast cell tumour, PATNIC intermediate grade, that had metastasized. There's a WHO staging system. It's not very commonly used, but I've given it here in case you're following the literature and you see papers that might talk about a stage zero mast cell tumour. That is an incompletely excised one. Stage two, regional disease. Stage four, with distant spread. The reason I don't like this so much is because stage three talks about multiple cutaneous tumours. And probably everyone here has seen dogs with multiple cutaneous mast cell tumours, where the tumours are completely unrelated and it doesn't affect the dog's prognosis at all. That's by far the most common scenario. If you're thinking one mast cell tumour at one side of a dog is the metastasis of the other from another end of the dog, then you have to ask yourself, does it look like this? Okay. If a mast cell tumour metastasizes from one site of a dog's skin to another site of a dog's skin, the chances are it'll be everywhere else, and it will be a very poor prognosis, and it'll be one of those cases where you gasp looking at the dog across the room. Much more subtle findings, like a couple of small lumps, are much more likely to be independent tumours occurring in a predisposed individual. Now, I offer two separate approaches to mast cell tumours based on whether they're low risk or high risk. Approach one, for the low risk tumours, I do a physical exam, I do bloods, urine as needed, I palpate the local lymph node, and if it's easy to FNA, I will do so. And I'll make sure there's no concurrent disease, and based on the findings, I might consider further diagnostics test if I'm worried about particular things. But basically, for low risk mast cell tumours, I don't do any involved imaging procedures or any biopsies or anything beforehand. I discuss with the owners that we may be recommending staging after surgery if the surgical results move the tumour to a high risk category. But since there's no negative prognostic factors so far, we'll work on the assumption that this is one of the 80% of mast cell tumours that we will cure with complete excision. For those mast cell tumours that have already got negative prognostic factors and are at high risk, we talk about the minimal staging plus FNA of the draining lymph node. Bearing in mind that 40% drain to a lymph node which isn't the closest, we will FNA the draining lymph node as well as the liver and the spleen and any other enlarged lymph nodes along the way. I would only image the chest if the mast cell tumour is on the front half of the dog. That's because the chest will contain lymph nodes on the way from the tumour to the liver and the spleen. It is incredibly rare for mast cell tumours to spread to the pulmonary parenchyma, okay? And you're not going to see nodules. If they do, you'll see diffuse infiltration in the same way a lymphoma case would infiltrate the lungs. So yes, image the chest if it's on the front half of the dog, but no, please don't look at the pulmonary parenchyma for nodules. You can refine this staging technique using sentinel lymph node mapping, and this is big news in people, particularly for breast cancer treatment. Here is the tumour. They've injected a radionucleotide and they followed it to the draining lymph node, and they know then what lymph node needs to be removed. It's difficult to work with radionucleotides in most veterinary practices, but with CT you can inject some contrast agent subcutaneously, and using bolus tracking you can track it go into the sentinel lymph node. And I'm happy to say this is a service I'm now able to offer in my practice. The implication of sentinel lymph node mapping is quite big, and if you haven't heard of this before, you certainly will do in the future. This study shows it quite nicely. You've got 19 dogs with mast cell tumours, and they had their primary tumour and the draining lymph node excised. They found that 40% of dogs were draining to a lymph node that wasn't the anatomical most closest one. They found that 12 out of 19 had mets. Now, 7 of these 12 were intermediate grade with low mitotic activity. And based on this mapping technique, 8 dogs were offered therapy which they otherwise would not have been offered here. So, sentinel lymph node mapping, very, very useful. So, I'll just remind you then, those cases that I would talk about the full staging with the imaging procedures, these are the ones that are high risk with the negative prognostic factors like ulceration, rapid growth, lymph node metastasis, oral mucous membrane location, recurrent tumours, or worries on the histopath reports. Then we would also consider full staging for those No, don't necessarily have negative prognostic factors, but the tumour is going to be very, very difficult to remove, and surgery is not going to be easy or cheap. For these ones, I'd do the staging I mentioned. I would also take a biopsy to get as much information before surgery as possible. So, in summary, then, I think it's perfectly fine not to stage a mast cell tumour before surgery, providing it's low risk and providing an appropriately large surgery is feasible and won't require radical or expensive procedures. I would also make sure the owner fully understands that we don't have all the prognostic information yet in these cases. We may need to stage later after the histopath report. So on staging mast cell tumours, has anyone got any questions? No? Okay. So, treatment of mast cell tumour, which treatment is the best? For all mast cell tumours, we should consider that there are two types of treatment. There's local treatment, principally surgery, possibly radiation therapy, but uncommon. And there's also systemic therapy, chemo or TKI therapy. For the low-risk tumours, I would talk about local treatment only and expect complete excision to be curative, okay? And we can use that cure word. That's fine to use. For the high-risk tumour, we'd talk about local therapy and systemic therapy. Local to treat the tumour, systemic to treat the mets or the risk of the mets. Now, it may be that you guys are thinking, well, actually, if we're going to give systemic treatment, do we need to bother with a local treatment? And the answer is quite convincingly, yeah, if you can, we should have local and systemic therapy for the high-risk cases. There's several papers, you know, there's quite a few actually. This one just being one of them, where you had dogs which all had distant metastasis and they had significantly better survival if they had the primary tumour controlled compared to those that didn't. So, surgery. For most mast cell tumours, we could talk about a 2 cm lateral margin and 1 fascial plane deep. Now, in my experience, taking oncology referrals, people are often really good at getting the 2 cm lateral margins, but often neglect the 1 fascial plane deep. So please don't do that. A common question I get is a mast cell tumour on a distal limb. Complete excision is going to be difficult. What options do I have? Well, with these ones, I would always take a biopsy first to get as much information. Is it definitely low risk or possibly not? And if it is low risk, you could consider surgery with proportional margins, okay? Proportional margins involves taking a lateral margin equal to the maximum diameter of the tumour. You still have to take 1 fascial plane deep. So the lateral margins technique is quite good and it will get, I think, about 95% clearance of low-risk mast cell tumours. If you've got a high-risk mast cell tumour, however, then I might consider an amputation or a more radical procedure. Proportional margins isn't going to be so clever. The other thing you could consider is radiation therapy as a primary treatment. Less available in the UK, but becoming more and more available, or medical therapy as a primary treatment. So, people often ask me about this one, can you use drugs to treat the tumour without removing it? Well, it's fourth in the line of preference, and for reasons that we'll come on to, medical therapy isn't so good. If you've got a tumour where complete excision is definitely not possible at all, still biopsy first, know what you're dealing with. But debulking the tumour and then using radiation or second best chemotherapy will get you the best outcomes here. The reason is if you debulk the tumour, you will shift the proportion of cells from the resting phase into the cell cycle. Okay? And as you do that, you'll make it more sensitive to drugs and radiation. Also, the more cancer cells that you physically take out of the patient, you have less cancer cells that are likely to spread or cause other trouble. So if it, if it's not possible, surgery doesn't have to be an absolute option. Just a debulk can be very, very helpful here. And if you're unable to debulk, then think of radiation or then medical therapy on its own. And for dealing with one local tumour in one place, radiation that focuses just on that area is much, much better than medical therapy, which will treat the whole dog. People often ask, would I use or ask my surgeons to use antihistamines in removal of a mast cell tumour? And if it's been taken out with margins, then no. Because with good surgical technique, the manipulation of the tumour should be absolutely minimal. And I'd only consider antihistamines if there are systemic signs, which there rarely are. If I'm using antihistamines, I'd use the H1 blockers like Piriton and the H2 blockers like ranitidine. If you've got a situation where degranulation has occurred and you've got, for example, bloody vomiting, bloody diarrhea, or you've got swelling of limbs, I would go in with omeprazole rather than the antihistamines. I'd also use sucralfate and I would use steroids. Don't worry about using steroids pre-surgery if necessary to stop a life-threatening event. You could also consider steroids to cytoreduce a tumour before surgery. Okay, I would use something like 1 mg per kg of Pred daily for a week and then look to cut the tumour. But that is not something I would encourage people to routinely do. The answer is simply that the nastiest cells will be the ones that are furthest from the centre of the tumour. The centre of the tumour is a very, very nasty place. It's low in oxygen, low in nutrients, and the only cells that are there are the ones that can't be anywhere else. You get a process of evolution and survival of the fittest going on, and the cells that acquire motility and are able to move away are also those that are better able to deal with stresses. And those that will survive the steroid therapy much better. So, if you're not careful, treating a tumour with steroids will kill off the low-hanging fruit, the easily killed cells, and leave the nastiest mast cells in situ, and you're not going to be able to easily see where there are. So, if you treat a tumour with steroids pre-surgery, you ideally should do the biggest resection possible. And from, theoretically, that should be the same size as it would have originally been. So steroids pre-surgery, only if you absolutely need to, please. After surgery, okay? The pathologist should be telling us, have we completely removed the tumour or not? And incomplete resection of a mast cell tumour is a nuisance. It's not the end of the world. If you've got a low-risk mast cell tumour that's been incompletely removed, I'd consider one of these four options. Number one, is revision surgery possible? Is radiation therapy possible? Is medical therapy possible? Or is it appropriate to monitor only? Because it's only between 11 and 30% of incompletely cut mast cell tumours recur. And actually, in a low-risk tumour, that's probably nearer the 11%. So yeah, it sounds very tempting, and the owners will instantly be drawn to this option. However, bear in mind that surgical excision of a recurrent tumour will always be harder and less likely to achieve complete removal. When you operate on a tumour, you'll break down the protective fascial barriers. So when it recurs, it might recur in strange directions that you're unexpecting. You'll also have the scarring from the previous tissue to deal with, making the tissue very, very difficult to handle. So, if it recurs, you'd potentially be in the worst situation here. If the tumour's high risk, then please forget the bottom option. We're not going to monitor that only. High risk tumours, medical therapy is indicated anyway. So in a lot of cases, you don't really bother if a high-risk tumour is incompletely cut, you give it medical treatment. But in some cases where you've got a lot of morbidity associated with a primary tumour and you definitely don't want that recurring, then another local therapy may be indicated. So we'll talk about medical therapy now. I'd like to mention five drugs: prednisolone, vinblastine, lomustine, tesarenib, Paladia, masitinib, Masivet. Okay. I'm not going to say too much about prednisolone. In general, it's a very weak treatment for mast cell tumours that only provides temporary improvement, if at all. I use it in the cases with a lot of swelling associated with the tumour or degranulation events, but not many others. And the effect is always transient and temporary. We can talk more about the cytotoxic chemotherapy drugs, vinblastine or lomustine. Vinblastine will kill dividing cells by messing up the formation of the mitotic spindle. Lomustine kills dividing cells by alkylating the DNA such that the DNA molecule can't be unwound and genes can't be transcribed or replicated. Vinblastine's intravenous. Lomustine's oral. Vinblastine's weekly, but when the tumour starts shrinking, you can go to twice to every fortnight. Lomustine is every 3 weeks from the get-go. So lomustine is instantly more attractive. However, vinblastine has only one principal side effect, and that's myelosuppression. Okay, it can suppress the neutrophils and platelets to a moderate predictable degree. By day 8, day 9 after giving, you hardly see anything. Lomustine can cause a very variable level of myelosuppression, which can be really severe, and it can also be very delayed as well. However, the biggest concern with lomustine is that either you can have cumulative myelosuppression dose on dose, which you don't get with vinblastine, or it can cause liver toxicity. And one study showed that about 30% of dogs on lomustine developed liver toxicity and half of them died because of it. Lomustine, then, it may sound attractive. And just like vinblastine, it very rarely upsets the gastrointestinal tract, so it's really nicely tolerated after it's been given. However, it's actually one of the scariest drugs we use, so I tend to favour this one as the last option. TKI drugs work differently, as we mentioned. The KIT receptor is involved in promoting cell division and cell replication in all mast cell tumours, and it does so only after this ligand binds to it. Okay, so the ligand binds, the cell receptor changes shape, sends signals to the nucleus which bring about cell proliferation. In about a third of mast cell tumours, the malignancy is driven by a mutation in this receptor such that it keeps firing, it keeps telling the nucleus to get the cell dividing in the absence of a ligand. And the TKI drugs will block this, effectively neutralizing this mutated receptor and the effects it causes. They can be dramatic. Look at this. It's a horrible mast cell tumor here next to a dog's anus, and a few weeks later, it had evaporated. Now, both of these drugs are oral, Masivet and Paladia. Masivet's daily, Paladia typically I would give 3 times a week. Masivet you could stick at the license dose, 12.5 mg/kg. Paladia is licensed at a much higher dose than you need. You will get identical clinical effects and much less toxicity by using a much lower dose of 2.5 to 2.75 milligrams per kilo on just 3 days a week. It's also important to bear in mind they're both licensed for gross disease only, where you've got a tumour that can't be removed. They're not licensed in the post-surgical setting. And side effects, well, actually, they're more likely to have GI side effects than the chemo drugs. You can also see things like hepatotoxicity with these, And you can see hypertension, protein-losing nephropathy, muscle cramping, lameness, and rare side effects like nosebleeds, IMHA, or thromboembolism. Now, which one should we use? Look at gross mast cell tumours, those that haven't been surgically removed first. If you use prednisolone on its own, the response rate is poor. If you use lomustine or prednisolone, response rate kind of 44, 47%. But what about the TKIs? About the same. Okay. So this is why I always tell people that mast cell tumours should be surgically removed if possible, because only about half of them will respond to any drug. It doesn't really matter what drug you choose. In human medicine, the future of TKI use is combining it with other cytotoxic drugs. And in one study, when Palladia was combined with vinblastine, there was a very high rate of response there. Okay, so that might be the way we go more in the future. Where you've got the c-KIT mutation, however, it makes it more likely for the mast cell tumor to respond to Palladia on Masivet. In the case of Palladia, it makes the response rate about 82% from about 43. You should consider, though, some important practical differences in using these drugs. Cytotoxic drugs like vinblastine or lomustine kill cells, and TKIs don't. So, if you're using a TKI, when do you stop? Have you got any suggestions? Because there's no defined objective stopping point here. Okay? So, that can make them really expensive. You could end up treating month on month on month for the rest of the dog's life, and the cost of one surgery could then pale into insignificance. TKIs could also be slower to work for the same reason. They'll stabilize the disease before it shrinks. And where you've got adverse effects here, as we discussed, vinblastine, pretty much myelosuppression only, lomustine, myelosuppression, or liver toxicity. I'll show this slide again of all the side effects that the TKIs could cause and the necessity for frequent and often expensive monitoring tests. Now, in human medicine, TKIs are much, much nicer than chemo drugs, but that's only because people get nuked with very high doses of chemo drugs and they get very, very poorly. In veterinary medicine, the prevalence or the severity of side effects from TKIs is actually not that different from the use of chemo drugs. And when you consider that TKIs need to be given all the time ongoing, the option of a short course of vinblastine injections may be the cheapest and the best tolerated thing too. So remember something I mentioned earlier. You've got in any tissue, whether it's tumor tissue or normal tissue, you'll have the resting phase and you'll have the cell cycle. And we can increase, can improve the response to a drug by making the tumor smaller, because that shifts cells from the resting phase into the cell cycle. Okay? So if you've got a tumor that you've started on a medical treatment and it's not shrinking, you could think about debulking it, and those would be the top options. You could also think about combining therapies with other drugs, but you need a lot of confidence using those drugs to do so. I would suggest talking to an oncologist if you want to do that. Now, where you've got a tumor that's been removed and you're dealing with either microscopic disease or the theoretical risk of metastasis in the future, we can't really talk about response rates because there's nothing that we can physically measure. But we can talk about survival times. And in this study, evaluating vinblastine and PRED after surgery for high-risk mast cell tumors, these guys live for almost 4 years. They can do very well. Here's another study, surgery with vinblastine and PRED, 65 months. Look at this. Surgery and then Masivet after surgery, only 12 months. I'd caution to take that too seriously, though, because this is retrospective data. We don't know whether the tumours in this group that got the Masivet after surgery were intrinsically nasty tumours. That's because although there's a spectrum of severity with the mast cell tumours, there also is a spectrum of aggression within the high-risk mast cell tumours. Tumours over this end of the spectrum may do quite nicely with appropriate treatment. Tumours over here will do much, much worse in spite of what you do. So going back to this study here, we've got to be very careful in interpreting it that the Masivet wasn't as good, because we don't know the exact composition of these two groups. If you look at further data from the study, the tumours that were metastatic at diagnosis lived for only 7 months. Out of the Patnick grade 3 tumours with surgery, vinblastine and PRED, they lived 6 months. Patnick grade 3 surgery and Masivet, 9 months. Okay? So be very, very careful in extrapolating data from retrospective studies like this. This study is of tumours at the very nastiest end of the mast cell tumour spectrum. They were metastatic and non-resectable, and they found that 50% responded to Masivet, but those that did had an average survival time of almost 2 years. So this is another feature of the TKIs that we're coming on to. Those that respond often do very well, and the c-KIT mutation status doesn't fully predict the response. So if we've got the choice to use the cytotoxic chemos or the TKIs in the adjunctive setting, I would always go with cytotoxic chemo first. TKIs are not licensed in this setting. They're not as well evaluated, and it's a very, very different biological situation here. Okay, so there's nothing to say that you can extrapolate the data from the gross tumours to the prevention of metastasis. In the gross disease setting, where the tumour can't be removed, I would choose whatever treatment based on convenience, costs, side effects. Bear in mind that the only way of assessing whether a TKI will work is trying the drug, and a month's therapy with Polidia or Masivet may be similar cost to running the c-KIT mutation. And the best treatment for each case is unclear at diagnosis. You just have to counsel the owner that you'll need to try something, and if it doesn't work, try something else. In a difficult case, you'll probably involve using both TKIs and both cytotoxic drugs sequentially. Let's get back to Muppet, okay? I told you Muppet had a swollen leg and a metastatic inguinal lymph node. Actually, Muppet didn't have mets in the liver or spleen or any other lymph nodes. And that's important. I would encourage you to think of three metastatic scenarios for mast cell tumours: those that are non-metastatic, those that are distantly metastatic in liver, spleen, or those that are metastatic to just one lymph node only. Because those that are metastatic to just one lymph node can often be cured. I'll say that again. Metastatic mast cell tumours that have gone no further than a regional node can be cured. You still need surgery for the primary tumour, or surgery stroke radiation for the metastatic tumour, and you still need to follow up with chemo. And yes, that can be really expensive, and it can involve a referral and a large spend. But these guys can be fixed. And what we're probably seeing here is a peculiar feature of mast cell biology. Mast cells are immune system cells, and normally they are allowed in lymph nodes at low levels. If you contrast that to epithelial cells in a carcinoma, you shouldn't really get them in a lymph node under any circumstances. So these mast cell tumours will find it easy to make it home in their lymph node, okay? So you may get a mast cell tumour that's finding it difficult to survive distantly, but it can survive regionally. So we have these three distinct things: distant mets, no mets, or intermediate, the regional mets. And it's worth staging these and finding out whether they're regionally metastatic, because they can be ones you cure. I can give you a little trick, because sometimes when you send cytology in for liver and spleen, the pathologist is unsure. They may say something like, I think there's more mast cells here than I might expect, so possible metastasis to liver and spleen. And as clinicians, we don't like possible answers, although we can understand why the pathologist says that. So we need to know as best as possible, is it metastatic in liver and spleen or is it not? That's going to dictate the direction of how we treat these cases. What I would suggest running is the c-Kit mutation here. Run the c-Kit on the primary tumour. If it's positive, run it on the mast cells you're finding in the liver and spleen. And the test can be done on the cytology samples. If the tumour's positive, but the distant mast cells are negative, you can assume they're unrelated. Okay? Can't really work the other way around. If you've got a mutation negative tumour, then it doesn't really help. But it's still been very, very valuable on certain occasions. So let's come back to Muppet now. Muppet has regional mast cell disease only. And I said the owners, I'm hoping we can fix this. Local therapy, course of vinblastine preds, hope for a good outcome. But they said no. They were tired. They didn't want any more. I guess they were a bit suspicious of what I was saying. They didn't want to go for any more. They wouldn't consider chemo on its own. So in the end, because they wouldn't accept anything else, I put the dog on masitinib and a tapering course of pred. And the leg swelling shrunk away very quickly over the next couple of days. And the tumour was disappeared and couldn't be found by week 8. And that was great. I did tell them that the response to a TKI will never be infinite, though, so it's going to recur at some point. Muppet developed a hepatopathy and proteinuria at 18 months, and we had to pause the treatment. And the owners didn't want to restart. Disease recurred at 26 months. And the owners reluctantly started the treatment again at 11 mg per kg, slightly lower. Okay. And we got a bit of the hepatopathy coming back with a slow increase in liver enzymes, but it seems to be stable at the moment. And to cut a long story short, Muppet's doing very well in remission at 39 months. Blood pressure is stable. So, although the response to TKIs is usually finite, you will get a very small number of TKI of mast cell tumours that are exquisitely sensitive to TKIs. Okay? Small number, in the order of several percent. So you can't, I wouldn't tell the owners about it. It would be wrong to let them expect this. But there are cases like Muppet and Bear here, who had distantly metastatic mast cell tumour, c-Kit positive, he'd failed vinblastine and pred. We put him on tesarenib, Palladia, and he stayed on it for 5 years and was put to sleep due to osteoarthritis. And you've got Huggy here, a high-grade mast cell tumour, Mets to liver and spleen, unresectable. We didn't run the c-Kit mutation here, but lived for 5 years on Masivet, eventually put to sleep due to heart disease. So, in a small proportion of dogs, you find that the mast cell tumour is exquisitely sensitive to the TKI, and the TKI can be the miracle drug for them. But sadly, it is a small number. So, in summary, please don't define a mast cell tumour by the grade alone. You need a comprehensive assessment of all the prognostic factors. After doing so, you then need to categorise them as low risk or high risk tumours based on the assessment of the prognostic factors. For low-risk tumours and high-risk tumours, surgery is the way to start, and in most cases, the low-risk tumour surgery will be curative, but it is indicated if possible in all mast cell tumours. Consider requesting further proliferation indices or further tests on the lab sample if you've got a borderline mitotic count, contradictory prognostic factors, or where you just want peace of mind. Remember that all mast cell tumours can metastasise, and staging for metastasis can be skipped if there's no negative prognostic factors and the client understands the risk of Mets is present. but low. Consider three metastatic states: distantly metastatic, regionally metastatic, and non-metastatic. And good outcomes can be achieved for the ones that are regionally metastatic or non-metastatic. Consider a course of chemo like vinblastine or PRED as the first medical therapy in the adjunctive setting. Consider TKIs or chemotherapy as first line in the gross disease setting. Remember that TKIs aren't safer and they're not better than cytotoxic drugs, but they can produce miracles in a small minority of cases. So I'm very sorry I've run on there. I hope you found this seminar worthwhile. I'd like to thank my former colleagues, Dr. Annalise Stell, Dr. Zanilar, and Angela Taylor at the RVC, and my colleagues who tolerate me at Highcroft Referrals. If you've got any questions after this, you're more than welcome to drop me an email, or I could be contacted at Highcroft Referrals. And thank you once again ever so much for giving up your lunchtime to listen to this webinar.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Owen for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.